The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I just set out to do this as a labor of love, and I never, ever obviously imagined this history would repeat in any way. I just wanted to give voice to the countless millions of victims of Stalin's atrocities and get some justice back. And for me, growing up as a Ukrainian in America, I'd always, you know, when I tell people I'm from Ukraine, the Americans would switch it in their minds and say, oh, you're from Russia. And on top of that, no one had ever heard of Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. So I felt a lot of this, I felt a lot of this pressure around me to try to set the record straight and build greater awareness and build greater healing through this story.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 1st, 2022. Andrea Chalupa is a writer and podcaster and Ukrainian-American who worked for 15 years on a screenplay about a man named Gareth Jones, a journalist who uncovered the genocide perpetrated by Stalin against Ukrainians in the early 1930s. The film is called Mr. Jones, and it was directed by the great filmmaker Agnieszka Holland and released in the middle of the pandemic. It is an incredible piece of work that could not be more relevant to the current news about the conflict in Ukraine. Chalupa joined me in the virtual jungle studio to discuss Gareth Jones. The New York Times reporter in Moscow at the time, Walter Duranty, her own grandfather, and the story of how she came to write this film. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 1st, Andrea Chalupa on Mr. Jones and Russia and Ukraine then and now. A quick warning, this podcast contains disturbing stories of graphic violence, including against children. So I want to start with the question of who Gareth Jones is and how you got interested in him.
Yeah, so Gareth Jones was a young, ambitious, independent Welsh journalist. He came from Barry, Wales, which was a port city at the time in Wales. I visited his childhood home, and growing up, he had a view of the sea where, and from all the letters and everything I've read of his life, he used to dream of big adventure and go down to the docks and interview the sailors. And as soon as he could, he set off for this life of adventure. He went to Cambridge University and then took all these exciting jobs working for a powerhouse publicist in New York City, which showed him the Great Depression firsthand and the Hoovervilles, the soup lines in New York City. Then he was a foreign advisor, a secretary for David Lloyd George, a fellow Welshman, and the World War I prime minister. So through that, Gareth was in the halls of power in London, and he used all of his connections to hustle his way onto a plane of the newly appointed Chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler. And from that flight across Germany with Hitler, he published an article saying that if this plane should crash, the entire history of Europe would be changed. And so Gareth was somebody whose star was very much on the rise, and he built on that by taking on his next big challenge, which was all the excitement in Moscow over the big social experiment of the workers' paradise. And that was sort of where our story of the film Mr. Jones takes place, with Gareth coming into town, idealistic, very much independent. He didn't have a editor behind him or newspaper back home. He wasn't your typical journalist, and that gave him a lot of freedom. And he also came from the political power world, so he was name-dropping to the Soviets, and that allowed him to talk his way through the front door in getting a Soviet sanctioned trip into Ukraine at the height of Stalin's genocide famine of Ukraine. He was supposed to be led by the nose as some useful idiot from the West, and instead he broke away from his Soviet handlers, went into the villages, witnessed the catastrophe of the famine firsthand, got out, reported on it, and he lost his perch in this gilded world of power and access when he became persona non grata for calling out Stalin at a time when that just simply wasn't fashionable. And there's all sort of reasons why it was politically dangerous. And he ended up paying the ultimate price, not just with his reputation and his career, but all the research showed that he was murdered on his next reporting assignment by falling in with two men with connections to the Soviet secret police.
So there's an immense amount packed into that.
Yes.
One element of which I just want to bracket, because we're not going to talk about it, but it would justify a whole podcast of its own, which is, you know, the story of how someone from a relatively sort of the periphery of the UK at the time, you know, managed to become a foreign policy advisor to David Lloyd George, worm his way onto Hitler's plane, con the entire Soviet government into allowing him to report the famine. You know, that, I mean, there's an incredible sort of human resourcefulness story here that I just want to put aside, because while fascinating, it's not actually why I wanted to talk to you about the movie. I want to ask you why this is the story. I mean, the truly remarkable thing, the reason we talk about this guy now almost 100 years later, is that it is not entirely clear that but for him, the story of the Ukrainian famine, which was a human-induced genocide, would have ever become public. Stalin had been incredibly effective at covering it up. And because of the fashionable nature of the Soviet Union in the Western halls of power at the time, it's not entirely clear to me that he would not have succeeded in covering it up, at least for a lot longer, had Gareth Jones not done this. And so I want to know the story of how you got interested in this and how near a miss we came to the actual deletion of this history.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I pursued this story because of my grandfather, who was born and raised in Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine, far east of Ukraine, that's now and has been invaded by Russia since 2014. My grandfather grew up speaking, writing, thinking in Ukrainian. And then along came Stalin, who engineered his famine, mass murdered something like 5 million people, the vast majority in Ukraine. And that included an all-out attack on Ukrainian national identity, banning the language, forcing people to speak Russian, liquidating the intelligentsia, and so forth, mass arrests, all of that. When I was growing up in Northern California, my grandfather was the world to me. He was just your typical grandfather and did all the things that wonderful grandfathers do. And when he, shortly before he passed away, he wrote down his entire life story in Ukrainian using an old Ukrainian typewriter. And he left me that book. And so after I graduated university and I focused on Soviet history, I moved to Ukraine for several months in 2005. And I had my grandfather's memoir translated. And it was all these incredible stories of being a young child, witnessing the Russian Revolution being fought on his family farm, watching his school, his whole community being transformed by the communists, people being disappeared. He was a young man surviving Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. And then as a young father with an infant son, he was arrested and tortured during Stalin's purges. So my grandfather essentially lived all the events that Orwell allegorizes in Animal Farm. And that's how Orwell eventually makes his way into my script, Mr. Jones, which we can talk about later. But so the whole idea of wanting to make this film, this project, came out of missing my grandfather, wanting to feel close to him again. And I sort of stumbled on it in college when I was supposed to be writing a very serious history thesis on Ukraine. And instead, I was procrastinating by going down the research rabbit hole into, well, what was Stalin's genocide famine? And my particular interest was Walter Duranty, because even as a little girl, I understood from stories from my family that there was this journalist by the name of Walter Duranty, and the same year he won his Pulitzer Prize for the New York Times, Stalin engineered this famine, and Duranty helped him get away with it. And I was just stuck with that. And so I was like, who is this Walter Duranty guy? And the more I researched him in college, I came across these really, really intriguing stories of how he was lovers with the Satanist Aleister Crowley. They would do these black magic sex orgies in 1920s Paris. Duranty would write Latin hymns for these orgies. They would do opium. They shared a lover for many years. And obviously, as a college student, you're like, this is incredible. And so that was sort of like my gateway drug, if you will, into imagining all this as a film. And so Duranty was sort of the start of some cinematic idea. Like, I couldn't let go of that. And so when I was living in Ukraine after college, I was searching for an anti-Duranty. Who was the guy that dared to stand up to him? And around that time, Gareth's family had uncovered his diaries and started promoting them in the press. And I was reading all about this. And so I was sitting in a internet cafe on Khrushchev in Kiev and reading all about this Gareth Jones. And it was just like struck by lightning. I was like, here's my hero. Here's my film. And I flew to London shortly after that and met with Gareth's niece, Cyril Coley, who's an incredible woman in her own right. She was a doctor, which was, you know, for a woman, that's very much ahead of her time. She raised four sons. And she, you know, Gareth was her uncle, her beloved uncle. He was the world to her. He used to make her laugh. He used to send her, you know, gifts and funny letters. And so Cyril and I came together during that time where I wanted to honor my grandfather. And she was happy to work with me and help me to honor her uncle who was murdered. And so I just set out to do this as a labor of love. And I never, ever obviously imagined this history would repeat in any way. I just wanted to give voice to the countless millions of victims of Stalin's atrocities and get some justice back. And for me, growing up as a Ukrainian in America, I'd always, you know, when I tell people I'm from Ukraine, the Americans would switch it in their minds and say, oh, you're from Russia. And on top of that, no one had ever heard of Stalin's genocide famine in Ukraine. So I felt a lot of this, I don't know, I felt a lot of this pressure around me to try to set the record straight and build greater awareness and build greater healing through this story. And Gareth, and your other question, how close have we come to having Gareth Jones not be one of the most important and critical independent voices that recorded the famine in Ukraine? I mean, it was remarkable, obviously, what he did, and he had the whole Western press establishment against him. There were other voices like diplomats and German colonists who were living in Ukraine, others that did speak out. But Gareth did have a voice of authority given all of his political connections. And he was relentless in publishing, getting the truth out there. Like, he would not let Duranty, with all of Duranty's denials in the New York Times, stop him. So I think it was Gareth leaving behind a long public record and putting his name and reputation behind it and trying to put pressure on other journalists at the time to do the same. So I think he's somebody that knew Ukraine well. In the film, we show it as his first journey. We had to use that poetic license just for efficiency's sake, but he'd been to Ukraine. This was like his third trip. So he was an expert in the country. He saw even on previous trips, he saw that the country was headed towards disaster under Stalin. So he had a lot of authority behind it. And like I mentioned, he was just tenacious in trying to get the truth out. So all those things combined really left an essential independent record that historians rely on today.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it in comparison to the Holocaust, which was also kind of in real time. People had, there was an argument about what was really happening, right? Were Jews being deported to the East and murdered, or deported to the East and, you know, put in work camps or resettled, right? There was some debate about it in real time, which was, I guess, resolved in the short term when Jan Karski, who is kind of the Gareth Jones figure, though not a journalist, of that period, revealed the, you know, came to London and revealed the existence of the camps. In the longer term, it was resolved by the fact that the armies of the Allies conquered the camps, right? And so we have these videos or these films. We have, you know, the actual records of the Third Reich. You know, we have the entire records of the German high command. And so the fact that the Axis lost the war and the territory and the camps themselves were conquered answered the question. In the case of Ukraine, of course, that never happened. And so I really do think that there is a, you know, that both the contemporary activity of the people who revealed it and the subsequent historiography, particularly of the, you know, Anne Applebaums and Timothy Snyders, you know, the subsequent historiography and the contemporaneous actions, like, actually bear a lot more of the weight of what we know than is true of the Holocaust. Is that right?
So you're saying, yeah, like in real time, the Holocaust was uncovered with the end of the war, and had generations to sort of come out the full extent of it. Whereas the famine in only recent years, the scholarship has finally sort of showed up for it. I think that's true. Obviously, Gareth Jones, as relentless as he was, the history was ultimately buried. And in the same year where Stalin's famine was killing the most people, the U.S. under FDR's government officially granted the Soviet Union recognition and open trade and open diplomacy and all of that. So Stalin was rewarded the same year he was mass murdering millions of people. And of course, Hitler's watching all this and starts building his first concentration camp. So the whole history of the famine didn't really come out in full. Obviously, you had Robert Conquest's book, Harvest of Sorrow. But it wasn't really until the fall of the Soviet Union where historians could not only gain access to archives in places like Ukraine, Soviet archives, but also the academics no longer had to bow down intellectually to the Soviet authorities to get full access. Anne Applebaum writes in Gulag how academia at the time, if you were a professor that was on the right side of the issues with the Soviets, you had an easier time. And that created this whole intellectually oppressive environment for trying to study these issues. And of course, you still have to this day, universities, teachers up and down the curriculum, teaching Soviet history through a Moscow lens. The Soviet Union is a gaslighting term. It wasn't a union. It was Russian genocidal colonialism, where you had all of these captive states, many that scrambled as soon as they could to enter NATO and are now safely protected under NATO. And you had so many cases of the Russians coming in, occupying countries like the Baltics and Poland, and liquidating the top cultural political elite and forcing language changes and brutal terrorism, oppression, and so forth. And we've studied that, the history of that period, through Moscow, through this idea of Cold War chess match, where the real drive of what this period was genocidal Russian colonialism. And we see it, of course, being repeated today with Putin's invasion of Ukraine, where he's just deliberately mass murdering civilians and bombing museums and all sorts of cultural records going back many years. He even bombed a Soviet archive, which is just gut-wrenching because these are important records we need to expose and keep this history alive.
Yeah, so I want to ask you about the political reception to arguments like the one you just made, because, you know, I worked with Anne Applebaum, you know, not on any of this, but we worked together while she was writing Gulag. And I was, you know, there was always a tenor of the reception to people like Anne that she was, you know, a right-winger justifying aggressive U.S. policy by focusing on sort of the Soviet Union in the particularly negative, with a particularly negative valence that she did. Whereas, of course, there's another way to think about that, which is just telling the truth. You know, there are a lot of people who would hear you say genocidal Russian imperialism with respect to the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, and before the last few months would say, come on, this is a fight between white people. This isn't colonialism. This is something else, right? It's the boundaries of one European nationalism with respect to another. And, you know, by the way, there were a lot of Ukrainian, you know, Axis sympathizers a few years later. And so, you know, please don't map the language of post-colonial struggle onto, or anti-colonial struggle onto this. You're kind of usurping or appropriating the language of, you know, anti-racist, anti-imperial struggles to map onto Soviet history. I throw that out there not because I believe it. I actually think it's an incredibly offensive argument, but because some portion of the listenership is going to have that reaction to the last answer you gave. And I just want to throw it out and give you a, you know, why is it wrong?
Well, anybody who has that reaction hasn't studied Russian genocidal colonial history, which is real and it exists. And no amount of political ideology can change that. And if people would like to get more coverage of that, one brilliant writer that I recommend is a guy by the name of Terrell Starr. He's a Black journalist from Detroit. He's covered a lot of Black issues through sites like The Root, where he was for many years. He's interviewed Kamala Harris and a lot of Black leaders and Black organizers. And throughout his career as a journalist, and he's always had a focus on Ukraine and Russia and also Georgia, because he spent time in those countries through the Peace Corps. He speaks Georgian, he speaks Ukrainian, he speaks Russian. And one thing he's always pointing out is that Russians see Ukrainians like some, you know, many white people, especially in the neo-Confederacy, see non-white people. And he talks a lot about how it was colonialism, plain and simple, and that yes, white people can colonize other white people, and just like non-white people can be instrumental in their own oppression, like a Candace Owens, for instance, so can Ukrainians, so can other members of the power structure, right? So Terrell did an amazing piece years ago in the Washington Post saying that Russia has a Russia supremacy problem. And we see it now in how Putin says Ukraine does not exist. His chief negotiator, Vladimir Medinsky, in these so-called peace talks with Ukraine right now, the guy representing Russia in the peace talks has said Ukraine doesn't exist. Ukraine's not a country. And a lot of the big folly we're witnessing of Russia's military in Ukraine is because they believed their own disinformation and stereotypes and dehumanization that's all over Russian propaganda. They believed that about Ukrainians. They saw you know, Russian state propaganda has said that Ukrainians are subhuman. So they really thought they could go in there and conquer all these subhumans. So they fell for their own sort of genocidal hatred. They're victims of their own genocidal hatred, if you will, with this bashing that they're now getting in Ukraine. So I think, and the reason why Ukrainians are putting up such a fierce battle as they are and risking their lives, and why so many Ukrainians from around the diaspora are returning home to fight, is because of this genocide that they've suffered under Russia in the past and that they're now currently facing. So yes, the history is very real. And this whole call, everything that I'm saying is also, I'm taking leadership from the left, progressives in Ukraine. A leading LGBTQ thinker, Maxim Aristavi, keeps pointing it out to other leftists in America and around the world, saying, this is genocide, guys. You need to wake up. You need to have solidarity. If you're of the left, if you're a progressive, you need to open your eyes to what's the reality here on the ground. And that, yes, this is a genocide. And yes, Russian imperialism has been driven by genocide against those who are not Russian. That's why you have out of the Kremlin this whole idea of the Russian world. That's what they call it, Ruskiy Mir, like this whole Russian world that's going to take over. That's Russian imperialism. And it's carried out through brutal genocide, brutal tactics of terrorism. And so I just take leadership from other progressives like myself and other experts in decolonizing our understanding of the world. And it all matches with the history and the facts on the ground. And just to sort of put us into these ideological boxes, I think it's really gross. I hate this whole idea of looking at the world as a chessboard. I think that deprives nations like Ukraine any agency. They're not a tool of any superpower. They want their independence. If you study closely Ukraine's Euromaidan, if you watch the brilliant documentary Winter on Fire about Ukraine's revolution, that revolution was a popular uprising that succeeded despite the West, not because of the West. I watched Euromaidan very closely, day by day as that played out. I launched one of the main hashtags of that revolution with complete strangers I joined with online. It was called Digital Maidan. We made that hashtag go viral to demand people focus on what was happening at Ukraine at a time when the West couldn't be bothered. And I can tell you that when Western officials came in from Europe and the US and tried to broker a peace deal with Putin's puppet Yanukovych and the sea of protesters, one kid got up on stage and grabbed the microphone and said, there's no peace deal. The president has until tomorrow morning to get out, or we're going to force him to get out. And sure enough, Yanukovych fled to Russia, where he's remained to this day. So I think people that want to put the world into neat little chessboard pieces, they're refusing to study the actual dirty, messy, chaotic reality on the ground, which is necessary to have a clear understanding of how the world works and where we are. And to sum up sort of like this further, because it does bother me greatly, is I remember going to a panel at the Brooklyn Museum organized by PEN America, featuring a delegation of Russian journalists and authors and editors, and the fancy, posh American journalist who was moderating this panel asked a question saying, well, hasn't the US and NATO driven a lot of this tension with Russia and Ukraine and so forth? Some sort of stupid question like that. And maybe it's a fair question to ask. All questions are fair to raise, of course. But it was some sort of typical leftist question like that. And the Russians on the stage looked at each other. And then one finally spoke up and said, well, sometimes things are black and white. Sometimes things are black and white. You know, as much as we have, you know, issues here in the U.S. that we must confront, and all these inconvenient truths that we must absolutely find the language to discuss, right? Like genocide and the neo-Confederacy and white supremacy and all of these issues that we absolutely must confront, continue confronting. We at least live in a country where we can have these discussions, where we can elect people to run for office. I made a complaint one time to a member of Pussy Riot about problems in America, and she looked at me like, at least you can run for office without risking prison, without risking being shot. And so it's the Russians in the resistance against Putin who keep reminding me of how many incredible rights we have here in America. And that freedom includes being able to call out our own government, call out the systems of inequality here. And that's our moral obligation. And we have to do that for others too, including all the Ukrainians that are suffering right now, and honor and acknowledge their own history, and honor and acknowledge that, yes, the term Soviet Union is gaslighting, and the accurate term is Russian genocidal colonialism.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Just one additional note on the phrase Ruski Mir, which you obviously know, but listeners may not. The word mir in Russian refers not just to world, but also means peace.
Right.
And so the phrase Ruski Mir is, yes, it's Russian world, but it has this weird overtone of something like Pax Romana as well, right? That there's a, you know, that there's a zone, a world of peace in the context of greater Russia. So it has this weird kind of Orwellian overtone to it that I think the translation Russian world doesn't quite capture.
Right. It's sort of like, so Putin called his military launching a total war against Ukraine as a peacekeeping mission. It's along that line.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I wanna talk to you a little bit about the history of the movie. I have many wonderful historical epics I would love to write a screenplay of. How does one do that and get Agnieszka Holland to direct it? That seems like a hell of a coup.
Yes, thank you so much. Well, I'm happy to always chat about this anytime anyone finds it useful. So yes, how does one go about writing a historical screenplay? So my whole story was, you know, I spent years researching and writing this script. I saw a lot of my friends that I started with in journalism skyrocket past me in their careers and get fancy media jobs and their own shows on cable news, where I was still juggling freelance assignments to give myself the time and the freedom to work on the script, even though it was going nowhere. And in 2015, I was really disheartened and I just felt so pathetic. And I was on the verge of giving up. And then I had a group of friends, Russian friends here in New York, invite me to a march in New York City in solidarity with Boris Nemtsov's anti-war march in Moscow and across the country. Boris Nemtsov was a charismatic Russian opposition figure. He was young, charming, brilliant. He would give speeches in Kiev saying that Russia must give Crimea back. He united Ukrainians and Russians. And for that, he had to be killed. And he was killed in the shadow of the Kremlin. And so days before we're supposed to do our march here in New York City in solidarity with Nemtsov's marches across Russia, I just saw the shock in the eyes of my Russian friends. Our march in New York City turned into a vigil for Boris Nemtsov. And I just became so angry from that I did essentially a page one rewrite of Mr. Jones. I just did this angry, angry draft where I just grabbed the reader by the throat and just said, how dare you not care about what's happening right now? All of this history is happening again. And I sent that angry draft of Mr. Jones to the great Agnieszka Holland, 3-time Academy Award nominee. People around her said, don't give your hopes up. She's saying no to all these excellent scripts with big names attached. And so I didn't know what else I was going to do if Agnieszka said no. And the only way I got to her was through our mutual friend, Tim Snyder, who wrote Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Tim Snyder and his wife, Marcy Shore, another renowned historian, they are friends with her. And I'm friends with Tim. I was like, I need her email address. So I went directly to Agnieszka's email. And I saw her in Toronto at the film festival, where she was on a jury there. And as soon as I met her, her mind was at work mapping out how we're going to get this film made. She was insisting we were going to shoot in Ukraine no matter what. She had all these big ideas for it. And I walked away from that meeting completely stunned, just needing a moment to realize that she had accepted to direct my screenplay. And she loved the script. She was just as angry as I was about what was going on in the world. The refusal of the European Union to see how dangerous Putin was, right? And all the appeasement of Putin across Europe. She wanted to open up people's eyes with this film, the urgency of this history repeating. Agnieszka brought her own personal connection to Mr. Jones. Both her mother and father were journalists in Soviet-occupied Poland, where she grew up, and her father's official cause of death was suicide while under police interrogation. So she had a lot to say with this film, and as soon as she finished it, as soon as she was done with the editing, she just hit send, and she wanted it out at the very next festival it could go to, and that was, of course, Berlin. And so she always had this urgency behind getting this film made, even though she's juggling all these other projects, big TV projects, because she directs a lot of television. She was always prioritizing us, always. She had a special connection with telling the story in an authentic way. There were times where we were offered several millions of dollars that we desperately needed to close the budget. But the big catch was she had to fire me and get a new screenwriter because people wanted new scripts, new versions of this. They wanted something more palpable, more Western, more sort of glossier, more. And she just kept saying no. So she stood by me even when we were desperate for financing. So she just was somebody who was just creatively courageous throughout. She gave me and the actors a lot of creative freedom. We were constantly rewriting on set. We never had any boardroom of a studio anywhere looking over our shoulder and micromanaging us. We were just no guardrails, just flying through the air together creatively and just coming up with whatever we thought was best in that moment. And it was probably the most spiritually enriching and exciting experience I've ever had. And so what you see on the screen is all of that richness coming through, all that authentic voice of every single artist who brought their touch to the film.
Yeah, and of course, Agnieszka Holland has quite her own prior history of making films about genocides through the particular lens of individual stories. She's, of course, the director of Europa Europa, which is, you know, one of the 10, 15 truly great Holocaust movies.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So I am interested in one aspect of the film, which is a choice on your part, which is to frame it with a story of George Orwell's engagement with Gareth Jones. And I'm interested, first of all, why you chose to make Orwell's understanding of this a kind of frame through which the viewer would understand the Holodomor, him or herself. But secondly, to what extent is that license, poetic license on your part? And, you know, to what extent did the two have a real relationship?
So Orwell made his way into the script because I turned to Orwell for inspiration. I was having a very difficult time getting anyone interested in the script. Gareth Jones versus Durante, that alone was a tragic story. Durante ultimately wins. The truth is buried. Gareth's life is cut short. He's murdered the day before his 30th birthday. Durante lives out his comfortable life in Florida and dies at a ripe old age in Florida. And so I needed to find something to, especially for myself personally, to give myself some hope, a sense that good conquers evil and all this. And so I turned to George Orwell for inspiration. Like, how did George Orwell mass market the atrocities of the Soviet Union to a global audience? What was the magic of that storytelling? And as I was reading Christopher Hitchens' introduction to Animal Farm, Hitchens mentions very briefly that Orwell struggled for years to get Animal Farm published, and somehow a copy ended up miraculously in the hands of Ukrainian refugees who immediately understood the book's profound significance and got a hold of Orwell's home address in London and wrote him letters. And with Orwell's blessing, they translated Animal Farm into Ukrainian and gave it out in the refugee camps of World War II. And I was immediately struck by that. That was my happy ending, where, you know, Gareth gets killed and silenced effectively, but then Orwell picks up. Orwell continues the work, and he gets the story out there in a very big way through the power of art. And so I incorporated Orwell into the script, given all that. And shortly after I did that, I had dinner with my aunt and uncle at their farmhouse in the Catskills. And I was telling them all that, you know, I told them about how Orwell's now in my script and how Orwell is in there now because of this incredible story of Ukrainian refugees creating a Ukrainian translation of Animal Farm and getting the truth out there. And my uncle looks at me and goes, "Oh yeah, I have a copy of that Ukrainian translation of Animal Farm. I picked it up in the refugee camp when I was a kid." And then my aunt gets up from the table and comes back with this yellowed, tattered book that I'd seen so many times in my research, and then gave it to me. So when my uncle, who's my mom's brother, And this is my mom's father, the grandfather that inspired the whole film in the first place, when their family immigrated to New York City with only what they could carry, they took with them this Ukrainian translation of George Orwell's Animal Farm, and it's still in our family. And that's how much that story meant to them, finally getting the truth out. And so that's how Orwell ultimately made it into the film. And Agnieszka loved it. Agnieszka wanted to keep it. And the real life connections are that that George Orwell, young Eric Blair was his real name. Eric Blair and Gareth Jones were about a year apart in age, and they were both represented by the same literary agent, Leonard Moore. And they're both friends with Malcolm Muggeridge, another journalist who was based in Moscow and finally left because he was so disgusted with the Soviet lies. And so those were the real life connections between them. And Agnieszka wanted a scene where they actually meet. The original idea was that George Orwell would serve as a Greek chorus and he would come in and out. But Agnieszka wanted to bring them together, which I think works really well, because when we meet Orwell in the film, it's 1933. He's still on the fence about the Soviet utopia. He needs there to be a Soviet utopia, like so many on the left. And it wasn't until years later in 1937, where he and his wife get married. They go off to Spain to fight fascists on their honeymoon, and they're hunted by Stalin's agents who are carrying out Stalin's purges on the front lines of Spain. And then he comes out and writes, of course, his great book on the Spanish Civil War. And that itself becomes this enduring eyewitness account of Stalin's purges and how they impacted the Spanish Civil War and the cause against fascism, and how many on the left refused to see it. And because so many on the left refused to see it, Orwell then goes on to write Animal Farm, a book so simple even children can understand it, because he wanted to open the eyes of his fellow progressives and say, stop worshiping that monster Stalin. He's not who you think he is. And he's going to actually bring down our cause. And Gareth and Orwell were both these independent spirits, very much of the left, very much of greater equality and human rights and they're nonconformists, and they put the agency of the victims of history first and foremost. They wrote passionately and with great empathy for those that were otherwise seen as chess pieces by the great powers of the day. And so spiritually, intellectually, they're very much linked as well. And so we wanted to make that connection in the film.
So you mentioned earlier that there were a few points of license in the film. For example, describe in the film that this is his first trip to Ukraine. It was, in fact, his third. I was struck in watching the film at, with the exception of the Orwell relationship, at actually how few points of license there are. That, obviously, the dialogue is made up, but the facts as depicted in the movie are remarkably consistent with, you know, the historical record, and certainly on all the major points. What would you describe as the sort of major areas where you took poetic license, other than in obviously fictionalizing dialogue that we need to have make sense in order to tell the story?
Right. So there's one reviewer who wrote something like, "The strangest moments in Mr. Jones are true." Like, sort of the stranger the moment, the drawn to you with his hedonism and all of that. So yeah, so the beats of the story are historically accurate. Obviously, in telling the film, I used a Alfred Hitchcock approach where you show the knife, but not the knife going into the skin. We wanted just to show a bit of the horror. So we don't show the full extent of Stalin's genocide, famine in Ukraine, the full extent of the horror.
Although,
my
lord, I mean, there's a half hour in the middle of that film that is as hard to watch as anything in film I've ever seen.
But it's tame compared to reality. If you want the full grimness of it, there's so Tim Snyder's Bloodlands goes into how horrific it was. If I did a true-to-life famine film of what Stalin did to Ukrainians, it would be a Saw movie, just one of those really over-the-top, grotesque films. You had orphanages overrun with children, and there's a report that some of the children, in like a fever of hunger, just turned on and started eating live another child. Like it was just really, it was hell on earth that Stalin unleashed on Ukrainians. And so obviously we had to show bits of that. And in Gareth's own journey in March of 1933 in Ukraine, he was witnessing people on the verge of death. He didn't necessarily see dead bodies, but we had to show some of that in order to give people a glimpse of the true horror of what it was like. And there's a scene in the film where there's a scene in the film taken directly from my grandfather, from what he witnessed, what he wrote about in his memoir. And we put it in front of Gareth, where he witnesses it. But this was a very common sight where Gareth is walking along and he sees a body collector collecting dead bodies off the street and putting it into the cart like trash, the cart behind his horse. And there's a still living infant pawing at his dead mother, trying to get her to wake up. And the body collector comes and takes the dead mother and the still living infant and throws them in the back of his car on top of the pile of bodies and just rides off to the local trash, to the local dump to bury them. And my grandfather witnessed that. And so we had Gareth witness that just to give people an idea of what this was like without overwhelming them.
So let's talk about Walter Duranty, who, as you say, died in Florida as a Pulitzer Prize winning former New York Times Moscow correspondent. When I was a young editorial writer at the Washington Post, Donald Graham, who was then the chairman of the Post, got disturbed by the fact that the Times had never had to account for that, and that the Pulitzer Board, I think he was on the Pulitzer Board, or maybe Fred Hyatt was, I forget what the institutional relationship was, but the Post always has a representative on the Pulitzer Board, and had never sort of taken account of that. And, you know, I think the spiritual ambience of the concern was, gosh, you know, if in the middle of World War II, the New York Times had a reporter in Berlin, you know, earnestly posting, publishing articles that there were no death camps under SS auspices in Poland, and had won the Pulitzer for it, there is no way we would have gotten to 2001 or 2002 without an accountability for that decision. And so he asked, I think this is reasonably public at this point, he asked Ann Applebaum, who was one of my colleagues on the editorial page and was a, you know, had just written Gulag and was doing research that would later become Red Famine. You know, he asked her to look into this. And the two of them kind of made a case to the Pulitzer board that it should revisit the Durante Pulitzer. And they were very quiet about it because the optics of, you know, a cabal in the associated with the Washington Post seeking the return of a old New York Times Pulitzer would have a sort of valence in the politics of journalism that would be optically ugly. And so they were keen not to make a big deal of that, about it publicly, although I don't think either of them would mind my talking about it now, 20 years later. But the Pulitzer board ended up making a statement that I think remains a completely shameful statement, which basically acknowledged that the reporting was deficient, acknowledged that the history that we all know to have happened, in fact, happened, and yet said we can't really retract Pulitzers once given. And so I continue to think this is almost mind-boggling, and I just actually don't know how to process it, even 20 years later. And I've never really taken the Pulitzer Prizes seriously since then. The fact that Durante's Pulitzer was never revoked shows up as a kind of coda in Mr. Jones, and I'm just curious for your feelings about it and your sense of what it means that in 2002, which sounds like a long time ago but isn't, the Pulitzer board actually spent time thinking about this and had the benefit of all people, Ann Applebaum submitting, I think, a pretty substantial document on it, and decided, nah, it's fine, you know, Stalin's reporter in Moscow is good enough for us.
Yeah, it's infuriating. So what happened was, it wasn't just Ann, it was also a big grassroots movement of Ukrainian Americans protesting the New York Times. And so the New York Times then hired a historian to be a consultant and review Durante's reporting, which won him the Pulitzer Prize. And this historian, Mark von Hagen, who I believe was at Columbia University at the time, he came out and said, you know, Durante won the Pulitzer Prize for articles that were essentially Kremlin press releases. And he made the assessment that his Pulitzer Prize should be taken away, that it fell very short of the standards. But more than that, he aided a genocide. And what ended up happening was, I think it was the New York Times executive editor at the time, Bill Keller, releasing a statement talking out of both sides of his mouth saying, we don't stand by Durante's reporting, obviously, but if you take away his Pulitzer, that's like erasing people from history, which is what the Soviets did. And so that sent a signal, of course, to the Pulitzer Committee that the New York Times wouldn't be happy about losing this Pulitzer. But what Bill Keller gets wrong is that in 1931, when Durante was publishing Soviet press releases in the New York Times that would win him the Pulitzer. So in 1931, Stalin was already laying the groundwork for his genocide against Ukrainians. There was a Soviet film, of course, made by the state, dehumanizing Ukrainians, showing Ukrainian farmers as a villain, as locusts that needed to be destroyed, using all of this genocidal hate speech to dehumanize Ukrainians. All of the same sort of genocidal hate speech that's been coming out of the Kremlin and Putin in years leading up to his total war against Ukraine. It's the same thing. And if you and anybody that studies genocides and how they work, they always begin with hate speech. They always begin with rampant disinformation and propaganda to lay the groundwork to justify the mass murder, to dehumanize the victims. And that was already well in motion when Duranty won his Pulitzer Prize. So Bill Keller and the New York Times try to minimize that and say, well, Duranty won his article, won his prize for 1931 and the famine happened in 32. The famine didn't happen by simply flipping on a light switch and overnight millions were dead. It needed all of this groundwork to be laid first. And that is what Duranty covered up deliberately with his Pulitzer Prize winning Soviet press releases, and then covered up again when he published in response to Gareth Jones, when Duranty published in the New York Times, there is no famine. So he helped the Soviets get away with a genocide. How many Pulitzer Prize winners have done that? Hopefully not many, but Duranty, I know Anne Applebaum has pointed out that the Pulitzer Committee doesn't want to go down that whole slippery slope of investigating Pulitzer Prize winners from the past because of all the dirty things they might uncover. But Duranty is an extreme outlier. Duranty was a Pulitzer Prize winner who won his Pulitzer Prize at the same time by helping the Soviets lay the groundwork and then later get away with a genocide. That is an extreme case, and that is why he should lose his Pulitzer Prize. If we're taking down statues to Confederate generals, if we're taking down statues to Stalin and Lenin and the founder of the Soviet secret police in Ukraine and elsewhere, then this is a statue that needs to be taken down. You know, it's the same argument. It's the same reason. This is a symbol of genocide, this Pulitzer Prize. And I also want to point out that when our production, when the Mr. Jones team reached out to the New York Times to ask them if we could quote Duranty's March 1933 article directly in our film where he denies the famine, the New York Times said no. The New York Times said no. I remember sitting on set in Poland with Agnieszka, the two of us alone in her trailer, when we just got this news, and we were just staring into space, trying to wrap our brains around why the New York Times would deny us the right to quote Duranty's article, his actual article. What were they trying to hide? What were they trying to cover up? What was their reasoning behind this? We simply didn't see it. So there's been this weird resistance by the New York Times to try to protect. They don't stand by it. Obviously, they say all the right things there, but they're not being helpful in trying to heal this history and confront this history in a way with, you know, with respect and integrity. They're being really shameful.
Yeah, so I actually think that latter point emphasizes an area where I would actually disagree with you. I don't think this is like Confederate statues or a statue to Stalin. A town that has, and don't get me wrong, I am not for the maintenance of Confederate statues, but a statue to, you know, a memorial to Nathan Bedford Forrest in a town in the South, that town is not an institution whose motto is all the news that's fit to print. The town is not an institution dedicated to informing people. It is not an institution that, you know, insists that its work in life has something to do with truth. The New York Times is such an institution. It has no business telling you and Agnieszka Holland that you can't quote their most shameful moments. And similarly, the Pulitzer Board is unlike a town that may build a monument to, you know, or the Soviet Communist Party that may build a monument to Lenin, is an institution that's supposed to be, you know, the Pulitzer Prize in these things is for people who best inform, who advance truth and understanding and knowledge. It's not a memorial. And so I actually think you're giving it, you may be giving it a little bit too much credit there.
Either way, the prize needs to go, and for Duranty. And the only way I see that happening is if there's another groundswell of grassroots efforts, which there is currently. There's a petition by a group of a Ukrainian grassroots organization And if people can find that petition on ukrainegenocide.com, where they can sign a petition to demand that Duranty finally loses his Pulitzer. And you also need a lot of experts like Anne Applebaum, like yourself, to come out and demand this as well. So it needs to be a bottom, top, all of it, up and down approach to finally putting pressure on the Pulitzer board. I think the time is right, especially given that this history is repeating in Ukraine today.
I cannot recommend this film highly enough for those who have not seen it. Andrea Chalupa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Hey folks, become a material supporter of Lawfare. You know you should, you know you want to, so just do it. Get ad-free podcasts, get some cool other stuff, join us on Lawfare Live. You know, patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.